Hello, everybody. This is the Alexi Sale podcast number 14. And it's me and my sidekick.
Hello.
Talal Karkouti. Hi, Talal.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Masalam.
Masalam alaikum.
Alaikum salam. And to reflect, YouTube comments on the last podcast, which was called Hollow Point. One person I saw said, "This is creepy."
Yeah.
And they tuned out and then tuned back in again, which I agree, it is creepy. I did a little bit more research on Hollow Point. The reason it is, the Hollow Point bullets are more destructive, but also because they kind of splay out. They don't exit the body, so you don't get rounds ricocheting around the room. So they just damage the person you're aiming at.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's
doubling down.
Somebody said, you know, when things get better, why not visit the Bovington Tank Museum? As if I haven't been to the Bovington Tank Museum. Are you kidding me? I mean, I am Panzer 131. I mean, that I am all over that museum. But there's an interesting thing about the Bovington Tank Museum is that it is right next to Monkey World. You see those kind of brown and white signs. One says a tank museum, the other says Monkey World. Now, it's always been my dream, really, that they combine the two. So if you could get monkeys driving tanks, I think that would be the ultimate.
Just take rid of one fence is all it would take.
That's all it would take, man, yeah. The monkeys, they could learn. I mean, you know, to see a monkey, to see a bonobo or a macaque at the controls of a Panzer IV or a Soviet KV-1, I think would be something to see.
Would you be up for going doing a video up there?
The Bovington Tank Museum?
We can go do a video and you can give us your take on the...
I suppose so. I don't know whether you tanks. Can... I went to the... I don't quite know. I went to the Royal Chatham Dockyards Museum with me and Linda. Went a couple of weeks ago, and that was great. Met quite a few people who were fans of the podcast, and I also there was a friend's wedding in Devon recently, and we went for a walk the next day in the countryside, and we bumped into only one person, and he was a big fan of the podcast. So from that, I extrapolate statistically that everybody in Devon is a huge fan of the podcast, which is why it perplexes me that we've only got £312 in the Patreon. Yeah. Come on, people. Give me some more fucking money.
Give me some more money.
Everywhere I go, people say that they're enjoying the podcast, really. So that's nice.
It's very positive, but podcasts have rarely become, you know, fortune-making endeavors for people. But, you know, massive thank you to our new patrons, Rob,
yes,
Andrew, and Patrick, one of whom has chipped in 20 quid a month. That's the kind of Patreon we like to see.
Yeah, yeah.
20 bob a month.
Yeah.
You're going to get a big fat nothing for that, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that'll get you. I'll probably visit your house you know, a holiday, you know, like Diwali or something. Did I tell that story about John, what was he called? He used to support me, John Otway.
No.
He had a single out, and one of the singles was blank. It was just a backing track. And so the prize was that if you bought that single, which somebody did, he would then turn up at your house and sing to it.
Oh.
And so that happened. He did, but he turned up drunk and he was sick behind their couch.
Oh, that's so a bit more than they bargained for. What, only one person bought?
Yeah, there was only one. It was like the golden ticket.
There was one of them that had a blank.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It was just the backing track, yeah. It was a good idea. It just fell apart because it was Otway.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether that's an apocryphal story. I think it's true. It certainly sounds pretty Otway, if anybody's familiar with the gentleman's work. Yeah, he's still going. Yeah, yeah. We've got some amazing, I think we've got really interesting, we're continuing our A to Z of left-wing thought now, and this week we're going to do Bolshevism and communism with Professor Tony Collins of De Montfort University, Leicester, and he's got some really amazing things to say. But I think do people prefer this, me talking to academics? I prefer talking to academics rather than me talking to comedians. But
we got some really, really nice feedback from the Professor Paul Preston interview. I think it's not expected, but that's kind of the beauty of it. And people weren't expecting this to suddenly become, you know, interviewing professors and stuff from around the country. And that's really fucking cool. And giving people something different. And to be honest, the feedback has been pretty universally nice and positive about it.
Good. No, that's good. I also think professors are, you know, you mean left and right, mostly right. You get all these like dickhead commentators on the news, you know, like, I don't know, Dan Hodges or even, you know, Aaron Jones, or who really don't know much about anything. But when you get a professor on, they just know so much. And I know sometimes they're not, well, because they often challenge, of course, the established, you know, the narrative, really. And so, you know, they're on very often. But I think I always think professors know so much more than every other idiot who's on there.
Which you get into in the media. Interview. You touch on
that. Yeah, do I? Oh, well, and, there you are.
why do you think that is, though? Yeah, it's because what the media, they're trying to design what the conversation is.
Yeah, well, we live in a world of kind of superficial thoughts, don't they? They don't want anybody thinking deeply and with knowledge about shit. They just want people to do kind of emotional kind of reactions, you know, right off the bat, really, you know, just kind of first order, kind of sentimental. You know, they don't want people to have either knowledge or to think deeply about the way of the world, because if they did have both knowledge and think deeply about the way of the world, then they wouldn't put up with this world that we have, I think.
Yeah. You want some insight on a topic? Don't invite a fucking expert on that topic. No, get fucking Keith Chegwin to come and talk about it.
Well, don't invite an MP for a start.
So that's what you're doing different, and that's why people are loving it, Alexi. You're bringing on actual experts. And
letting them speak, you know, not... Don't ask if you want to... Yeah, don't invite... Ask some commentator or...
Yeah.
Particularly don't ask an MP.
Idiots. And it's really nice to listen to you learning, because like I've seen a pattern now. Both times you're learning shit, because like
and I'm not putting that on, because I mean I realize that even I, as a, you know, somebody who thinks of themselves as being left wing, that I've absorbed a lot of I think right wing messages, really. And obviously with Professor Preston, there was a whole kind of debunking of the Orwell / Spanish Civil War myth. And I'm not faking it. It is these talking to these professors is a learning experience for me as well.
And Professor Tony Collins is who we're interviewing today from De Montfort University. Yeah. Shall we
just go straight into it?
Jump into it?
Yeah, why not?
What was the reminder, listener, what was the letters of the alphabet? What's the topic?
B and C, Bolshevism and then communism. And I mean, I think these topics are so vast in a way that we're, you know, as with Professor Preston and anarchy and the Spanish Civil War, we hardly, you know, feel like, you know, you could go on for hours and hours and hours, really. We only skim the surface, really. But, you know, it's still fascinating listening, I think.
Well, yeah, if you want more, go sign up for a fucking course and learn.
Yeah.
Get the hours you need. All right, here we go.
So since my A to Z of left-wing thought has proved so popular in that we've done A, talking to Professor Paul Preston, we're now going to do B and C, and which is, I've said, is Bolshevism and Bolshevism and communism. And I have now, Professor Tony Collins, if you'd like to tell me your specific...
Yeah, great. Thanks for being here, Alexei. I'm Professor of History at the Montfort University, and I've got a book coming out in spring of next year about the origins of the British Communist Party and the growth of Marxism in Britain up to the 1920s, called Raising the Red Flag. So
that's your perfect guest. It's like, you know, it's like somebody's put some effort into this shit. I don't know. I mean, where to start? I mean, I suppose we should start with what would you say is Bolshevism, I guess?
Well, I mean, technically, Bolshevism is it started as a strand of Russian Marxism in the early 1900s when the Russian Social Democratic and Labour Party split into two wings, the Bolsheviks, which means majority, and the Mensheviks, which means minority. But bizarrely, the thing that they split over, how we define a member of the Russian Social Democratic Party, when the vote was taken at the conference, the Bolsheviks were in the minority and the Mensheviks were in the majority. So it does get rather confusing. But basically, it's essentially the idea that the working class should rule society and that the state should be in the hands of the working class and socialism established through that.
And what made the Bolsheviks so effective, seeing as they were in the minority and yet they obviously got to seize the largest country in the world? How'd you do that?
Well, good question. Yeah. If there was an easy answer, we'd all be doing it, hopefully, anyway. I think two reasons. One that they had deep roots in the Russian working class. They were a mass party of the Russian working class. Russia was in turmoil, and the Bolsheviks had a following amongst the factory workers and the peasantry. But also, most importantly, what differentiated themselves from all the other parties that were socialist or Marxist was that they had a clear plan for working class power. They said, what we want to see is a revolution that's led by the working class, that establishes a socialist state that is governed by the workers on the basis of workers' councils or Soviets, as they call them. And so when Russia, in the middle of World War I, when Russia was in absolute turmoil, the Tsar resigned, a new so-called democratic government was elected in 1917, the Bolsheviks were the only party who said, we've got to stop the war, we've got to give land to the peasants, and we've got to make sure no one goes hungry. The three key points, the three key issues that were at the core of the Russian Revolution. And the Bolsheviks said, the only way we can do that is by the workers' Soviets taking power, and they led that in October 1917.
I mean, I suppose in a way, although we're jumping forward to M, we should perhaps, given that the Bolsheviks were a Marxist party, maybe we should have a quick recap of what Marxism is. I know that's, we're jumping through. Yes, that's true.
Well, we've done the whole A to Z by the time we finished.
Yeah.
Well, I think that... Yeah, I know. But I think that, in a sense, if you go back and ask what communism was, then that's when you can see Marx and Engels, when they were very young, in the 1840s, joined the Communist League, which was a German organisation that, again, proposed that the way to solve humanity's problems of hunger, war, oppression, whether it's of the working class, whether it's of women, or national or racial oppression, was through a revolution that put the working class in power, a socialist revolution. And so that was at the core of Marxism.
So communism existed before Marxism, because they tend to be, kind of treated as synonymous, don't they?
In a sense, it's existed for almost as long as people have struggled against the prevailing conditions of struggle for equality. I mean, in England, if you go back to the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, the slogan there was, when Adam delved and Eve span, who then was the gentleman?
Fucking true, man.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. The idea being that the original state of humanity is that we're all equal and that property is held in common for the benefit of all. So it's an idea that goes back a long way, and you can see it in the English in the English Civil War, in the English Revolution in the 1640s with the diggers who believe that property should be held in common, particularly the land at that time. And then it really starts to acquire what we think of it in modern terms in the French Revolution, where the far left wing of the French Revolution, based on the Parisian working class, the sans-culottes, organizations arose that said that the poorest, the most oppressed should rule. And one of the most important organizations was Gracchus Babeuf's Conspiracy of Equals, which was essentially, if you like, an early form of communist organization that said everyone should be equal, property should be held in common, and we need a revolution. The French Revolution needs to go forward. And it's the French Revolution of 1789 was only the first step. And that tradition of the Conspiracy of Equals kind of carried on through various people who've been involved in it through the early 1800s, 1820s, 1830s. And so you get people involved in the Chartist movement in England. And that eventually leads to the organizations like the German Communist League that Marx and Engels joined in the 1840s and for whom they wrote the Manifesto of the Communist Party.
And what do you think it was then that about that Marx and Engels brought to the party that in a sense made it stick, at least not temporarily, although it didn't work out that well in the end?
But, well, I think a couple of things. That they were... people tend to think now that they were great thinkers, great ideologues, great philosophers. They were about ideas. And that is an important part of it. But they're also active revolutionaries. So they'd fought in the German Revolution in 1848 that was unsuccessful. So they had an awful lot of political experience. They also understood that you had to take the experience of different parts of the world. So the classic idea is that they took French socialism, German philosophy, and English economics, and use that as the basis to develop what became known as Marxism, which they're already talking, the Communist Manifesto of the late 1840s, is an encapsulation of those early ideas. And right at the very heart of it, as many people know, is the idea that the working class should take power in all countries eventually. And so it ends with the famous words, proletarians of all countries unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains.
Okay.
How does that compare with your knowledge? Because obviously your family background, how does that gel with what sense of it is?
Yeah. Well, in a sense, it's one of the things I realise is that my knowledge of it is, and one of the reasons that I'm doing this in a way is to understand my own, that as the child of revolutionaries and a revolutionary myself, at least for a brief while, that still only partially knew, didn't understand in a way what I was part of, really. And so, doing this is actually an attempt at the age of 68 to understand what I was doing when I was 19. So I don't know whether that's a flaw in me or I don't know. I mean, it's just... we'll talk about communism, the British Communist Party, won't we, really? We'll come on to that, really. It always seemed to me that the British Communist Party didn't allow its members to study the sacred texts themselves, yeah. But, had the Catholic Church had the ideology kind of handed down to them, really. We did study the sacred texts, and I do have a kind of, I do have a working knowledge of Marxism, really. So, I mean, which I garnered when I was 18, 19, 20, and then I've clung to like a life raft ever since, really.
Well, I'm kind of the same, yeah. So I was a teenage Trotskyist. and I haven't really changed very much. In fact, I've got more grey hair, but...
Yeah. But it's fascinating, really, to... it's just really interesting, I think, to go into... I mean, it all sort of makes much more... I mean, it all makes a lot more sense to me now, but I'm just become fascinated in the last few years by the, to fill in the holes, really, I suppose you accept a lot, really. You just think, the Bolsheviks took power in the Soviet Union because they did, but then you... I'm sort of fascinated to know, like I said, like why I asked you why and how it was achieved. And I suppose also because the last 5 years where we seemed, although it's perhaps illusory, that we were going to get close to, some kind of socialism in Britain, some kind of change. And I'm just very angry about that, really. And I want to see if there's a way.
Well, I think a lot of...
you know, a lot of people I know, it's the same, we're having the same conversations, because, you know, there was a moment when Jeremy was elected when I think a lot of people thought, hang on, there's something with real potential happening here.
Yeah.
And then the way that was absolutely, you know, destroyed by the right wing of the Labour Party and the press,
yeah,
and the media, you know, it makes you want to question, you know, what's going on? What is the absolutely solution? And I think, yeah, you know, how do we go forward? And I think there's a, you know, a lot of people are looking at, you know, Marxism, communism, anarchism. Obviously, you had that discussion on the last time. So, yeah, I think it's a sign of the times that there's
it, and it's really, I think it is, it, you know, the, it is the, you know, there's a, I don't know, there's an answer in there somewhere, but there's a kind of a, you know, there's some interesting questions, which I think I really want to open up, really. I mean, the thing about, I mean, to return to the Bolsheviks, I mean, is that they were, I mean, they were people who were forged in a much more, that they were forged in a brutal, brutal war. And they were also, I guess, more ruthless themselves. I mean, they seemed, I mean, Stalin is often sometimes seen as the kind of epitome of Bolshevism, but really Lenin, and, I mean, Lenin founded the Cheka and, you know, instituted the terror and, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe that's what you need, you know.
Well, I think there's a difference between Lenin and Stalin, and also because in a lot of ways, I mean, you think when the Bolsheviks actually seized power in October 1917, I think there were something like 3 people killed.
Right.
And it was only in late spring, early summer of 1918 when the Allies suddenly realised there's something going on here. There was 18 imperialist armies eventually ended up on Russian territory.
And that, I mean,
terrorist attacks, which is why the Red Terror was brought in, because somebody shot Lenin, almost died.
Yeah.
Yaroslavsky was killed. He was a senior member of the government. And so there was this fantastic fear at that point that it would be, the whole thing would collapse. And when you look back, the other thing that I don't think is appreciated now, when you look at the White Armies who were fighting against the Bolsheviks in collaboration with the Allies, Britain, America, France, and so on, they were really the precursors of the Nazis in terms of the, you know, the anti-Semitic pogroms that were carried out, particularly in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And for many people, you know, Bolsheviks were seen as Jewish anyway. So the two were, for those who opposed them, the two were indistinguishable. So there was a civil war going on. So the Bolsheviks had to do something, had to fight back and defend themselves in some way. But I think then when you look at Stalin in the 1930s, that's not the same situation.
No, but that's one thing that our fucking media never points out, is the fact that, what continually, I think, you know, in a way that the idea is that Marxist revolutions or workers' revolutions are inherently, you know, socialist revolutions are inherently reactionary, inherently corrupt. What they never fucking mention is their own role in this shit, you know, and it's never like the interference in like Venezuela, for instance, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, they were trying to push Guaido last year. It's Cuba. It's the same, you know, and starting with the Soviet Union, that, as you said, that, I mean, if you'd like to go into more detail about, I mean, British troops didn't leave the territory of the Soviet Union until, what, 1921?
Yeah, quite late on.
Yeah.
And they were, and even worse than that, at one point they were dropping poison gas on Russian villages that supported the Bolsheviks. They were giving backhanded support to the anti-Semitism, including Winston Churchill, who described the Bolsheviks as Jew commissars. And so you've got this tremendous wave of in a sense, terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism going on against the Bolsheviks. And it's not just in Russia. So in Finland, the Social Democratic Socialist Party in Finland tried to take power in 1918, was met by a massive wave of civil war, literally tens of thousands of people killed. In Germany, again, after the end of the war, you know, famously Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht were murdered, and they were just the two of the most prominent people who were killed by right-wing forces. So everywhere that you get the threat of working-class revolution or working-class revolt, you get basically civil war,
yeah.
terrorism,
yeah. And therefore
taking place against it, taking place against it from the so-called democratic countries.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore the revolutionary forces have to, you know, institute a regime of, you know, and a terror, or, you know, they have to institute a regime which unfortunately goes against the values that they're fighting for. And it's, so it's a win-win for the fucking capitalists in a way, because either they destroy the revolution through their actions, or the revolution destroys itself because of the actions that have been forced on them, I think.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, even in the early years of the Bolshevik regime, I mean, there was quite a wide range of democracy. So up until 1920, there was still Menshevik standing for election in the Soviets. And even, all questions could be debated in the Bolshevik party. And so there's, you know, contrary to the idea that you get if you read, you know, books by Robert Service or these type of Cold War historians,
yeah.
There's a huge amount of democratic debate going on within the Bolshevik Party. And quite often, Lenin, supposedly the dictator, is in a minority. I mean, the famous example over the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, when the Bolsheviks were faced with, do they sign a peace treaty with Germany? Germany, you know, the war's ended. The Bolsheviks have unilaterally ended the war. They say, right, we're not going to fight. And Germany says, great, we're just going to march through and take over. And there's a massive debate in the Bolshevik party about what it should do, declare civil war, sue for peace. Lenin, who wants to have peace because he realises that the chances of survival without a peace treaty with Germany are very, very slim because of the state that the country's been left in by Tsarism, is in a minority when he says we should have a peace treaty, we should sign the peace treaty with the Germans. And it's only through a long debate that Lenin actually becomes the majority. So far from being, you know, the idea that you get in the press that Lenin's some kind of dictator who everybody falls in with his will, whatever it might be. You know, one of the things about the history of the Bolshevik Party is that Lenin is often in a minority. He has to argue his case. He has to win a majority for his case right up until the early 1920s, when eventually he's too ill to continue, then dies in 1924.
I mean, so we were talking about the last 5 years. Yeah. Where, I mean, it was shocking even to me to see how somebody with a mildly social democratic platform, how the entirety of the media machine, of the establishment machine, was turned against him. You know, both the right wing, the Labour Party, obviously the right wing press, the fucking BBC, everybody, and also how cowardly people in my business were, that everybody panicked really and, thought they were going to lose their fucking sponsorship of their arena tours or whatever and turned against him as well. It was breathtakingly spineless, I thought, of everybody that they all chose. They made that choice to believe the various lies that were told about Jeremy Corbyn and the left of the Labour Party. I just wonder what you think is, if you have a kind of a solution to that, really.
I wish I did have a solution. I mean, I think that to some extent, that's a continuation of what's been going on for maybe the last 30 years. And there was this whole, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, there was this whole thing about the death of communism and the end of history. And there's been a massive onslaught against, not just against ideas of communism or Marxism, but just against ideas of socialism as well. That it's kind of, if you question the idea that, you know, capitalism and free enterprise are the natural order of things, as Jeremy Corbyn found, as you said, I mean, it's quite a mild program that he had. I mean, nothing that Harold Wilson would have would have balked at in the 1960s. Yeah. You're seen as if there's you're not taken seriously. It's you're seen as being beyond the pale, as not understanding. So, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist, or you don't understand reality, or, you know, you've got to be realistic about what
mm-hmm. you know, what you can do in society. Mm-hmm. When, and all the time this is going on, people are crying out for some kind of radical change. So you get it in a very warped way, because people have no alternative. So you get people, you know, voting for Trump in the States, voting for populism. And that's really what's behind the Brexit thing as well. People are looking to make a protest, I think,
yeah.
against situation, but because they've got no lead from the left. And, you know, as you said, the media is just really stamps on any idea that is close, anywhere near socialism. Then, you know, it's the only radical solutions are those coming from, you know, populists on the right.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because I've been thinking a lot about, is how you kind of counter that. And it's sort of like, I think sometimes people on the left, they try and, because, you know, the right makes these culture, you know, kind of makes these false accusations. And sometimes I think the left tries to do that as well.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, to kind of make those kind of whiny kind of, and that doesn't work because they, you know, we can't commit to it really. It sounds fake. I mean, I think the only weapon that we have is the truth, really. And that what one of the things that Jeremy failed to do, and I don't really blame him for this, because you can never, you know, I don't think anybody can imagine. I mean, I've been in a very, very minor way involved in a couple of kind of hoo-has, you know, like minor, yeah, you know,
like Desert Island Discs
yeah. kind of thing, yeah. And even that stops you thinking straight.
Yeah.
But to be like Jeremy and the people around him, to suffer that assault, you can't, you know, when the entire force of the both the kind of the center, as it were, that's the right wing really, and then the other right wing, the Tories, and the media, where everything is focused on you, it's very, very, and that's a deliberate tactic.
Oh, yeah.
It's so hard to think straight. It's so hard when you to make the right decision, you know. Nevertheless, I think that the only thing that we could have done, the only thing that Jeremy could have done, and I don't blame him for not doing it, but is to state the truth much more forcefully.
And I think you're right. And I think that was one of the problems that Jeremy and the people around him attempted to. They thought they could compromise. They thought there was some common ground, but there isn't. And to go back to history, it's not the same by any means. But I think it's as you say, you've got to tell the truth. You've got to stand your ground, and you haven't got to give in to their arguments. I mean, if you go back to history, 1917, Lenin comes back from Switzerland in a German train. So he gets to Germany, and the press, obviously the media's not the same in 1917, but all the papers are saying Lenin is a German agent. Look, he's been financed by Germany. And people still say that today. And it's that same sort of level of slander and lies that we use. And the Bolsheviks said, no, completely untrue. The reason why this has been said about us is because it's a diversion from the reality that the only way we're going to stop the war, get people fed, get land to the peasants, is through socialist revolution, the Soviets taking power. And there's a famous thing where episode in the summer of 1917 where they're at the Congress of Soviets. So it's delegates from all the parties, all the big cities. And one of the ministers in the government, the Mensheviks had members of the actual provisional government, and one of them says, "There's nobody here who would want to take power in this situation. Look at the situation we're in. You can't tell me anybody here wants to take power." And there's a voice from the back. Lenin stands up and said, "Yeah, the Bolsheviks will take power because we understand the only way that the people, the workers, and the peasants are going to get any satisfaction is through a workers' government, and we're prepared to put our hands up and say that's what we want." And I think that's what, you know, that's basically a lesson. It's not just a lesson for politics. It's a lesson for life, saying this is where I stand and this is what we want.
Because it seemed to me in retrospect, I mean, I didn't see it at the time, but people like John McDonald, for instance, who thought that you could bargain with, you know, you could
But the other, all those people who criticised Germany were bullies. And if you, and I know, like I've, you know, I mean, I was on Owen Jones's podcast where he said, you know, well, we, you know, we had to make concessions, we had to deal with them, but you know, the bad, there would be bad faith actors, but you had to negotiate. Well, fuck it, you know, you you mustn't, you can't. They're bullies. You can't make any concessions to them because they'll just take more and more and more.
The other thing about that is that, well, it's two things, but I think the other thing about that is that. All this stuff about anti-Semitism, right, sure, there are going to be, you know, a small, very small minority of people in the Labour Party who are anti-Semitic, but they're just as likely to be on the right, if not more so, than they are on the left.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is about discrediting the left.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Once you start making concessions to that,
yeah,
then you're lost because the ground has gone from under your feet.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and in a sense, again, going back to history, that's always been one of the problems with the Labour left, because they've, in a sense, they're more loyal to the Labour Party than the right wing of the Labour Party. Whereas the right wing, you know, it's just all with the Social Democratic Party in the 80s and where people leave now because they have a tantrum for whatever reason. It's always the Labour left that stay
loyal.
That's
a really interesting point, because I think, now I think, what the fucking hell are you doing in this party? Why are you sticking with this fucking horrible, horrible organisation full of fucking bastards?
Yeah.
And the reason is that they see it, that they're loyal to it, the idiots.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, for a long time, it's the idea that there should be an alternative to the Labour Party, it seems like pie in the sky, because... You know, the Labour Party's winning elections, it's got the trade unions behind it, millions of workers vote for it because they think in some way it's going to bring some form of socialism. Well, that pretty much doesn't exist anymore.
No.
The most trade unionists have lost faith in the Labour Party. You know, you look at the recent election results in traditional working class areas, the Labour Party's, you know, it's got no purchase on working class people because it's seen as a, you know, what's it done for them in the last 50 years?
Yeah.
And you know, I think that there's no other alternative. You can either keep banging your head against a brick wall in the Labour Party, or you say, well, we've got to look at what else we can do. And maybe that's outside of Parliament, but it's in the trade unions, and, you know, try and get some victories in strikes or just campaigns. I mean, did you see the, was it like a couple of months ago in Glasgow where just an only bunch of people in the streets stopped the immigration police taking away people for deportation?
Yeah.
So, you know, just little victories like that go a long way. And it means there's an alternative then. I think somebody's going to do something and they've got the backbone to actually get things done. And that's what's necessary.
Why can't... I mean, I still don't know why the socialist campaign group stay in the fucking Labour Party. I wish they'd leave and form another party. But the model has to be that it's both... It concentrates on actions, like you say, community actions and... you know, strikes and so on, but also I don't know whether it campaigns in a parliamentary form or whether you ignore that completely. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean,
what are the lessons of history?
Well, I think, first of all, you're never going to get socialism through Parliament, because Parliament, you know, look at the history of Parliament. It's there as a originally Parliament was developed as a way of for the ruling magnates, the aristocracy, to negotiate between each other and the reigning monarch. So it's really got nothing to do with democracy. And one of the things I think that's quite interesting is that there's a kind of veneer of propaganda that, you know, there's such things as parliamentary democracy, and that's where all of the real decisions are made. But you know, as we've seen again over the past 5-6 years, that's not really the case. I mean, even look at the way in which, you know, in 2008, the banks essentially told the government what to do and got, you know, massive. The magic money tree was brought out for the banks.
Yeah.
And so real power has always resided with the ruling class, the capitalist class. So I don't think that. So whilst you might want to use, you know, Parliament as a platform for propaganda, that's not really where the real power is. The real power is in the economy, you know, in the factories, in the workplaces, and I think that's where, you know, a new organisation, new movement, call it whatever you want, has got to be built. And that's, I think, the other problem is, and this goes back to the thing about the Labour Party, is that there's the Labour Party has always told people, just stick with us and eventually we'll get a majority and things will be different. And one of the problems with that is that they never have really got, despite the fact we've had, you know, numerous Labour governments, things are actually getting worse, and they got worse under Blair in a lot of ways.
Hell yeah.
Beginning of privatisation of the health service, student fees are introduced, you know, not to mention, you know, war in Iraq, Afghanistan and stuff like that. And so there was the old idea that just stick with us and we'll introduce socialism through, you know, slowly but surely, and we'll make things better for working people. It just doesn't really hold up anymore. And when you see what Keir Starmer's promising, which is, you know, I don't know what he's promising other than they're the loyal opposition to Johnson.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a hard thing to do. And it's in Britain, you know, because the Labour Party's been there for so long, it's a difficult thing to comprehend. But on the other hand, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
We elect Keir Starmer and, you know, you know, basically we get Boris Johnson without the idiocy, without the venality and the idiocy.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was just thinking then about, you know, the kind of the old, you know, the kind of Bolshevik revolution where, you know, comrades seized the telephone exchange, but the telephone exchange is probably yuppie flats now. So you'd be seizing let's seize a load of mid-century modern furniture and flat screen TVs. What are you doing in my flat? So,
whatever the internet is, isn't it? I mean, the internet is the modern equivalent of the telephone exchange. And
so we have to seize the internet, yeah?
Yeah. And I'm sure, yeah. That's, I mean, I think that's a little bit further down the... Sadly, that's a little bit further down the track. The mechanics of how we take power is a bit ahead of us. It's mainly, I mean, because to some extent, I mean, these things, once you get to that, once your ideas get that popular, then who knows what might happen.
Yeah. Well, and so I suppose to go back to the, a couple of things really. We might as well, because you actually write about rugby as well, don't you? So in a kind of Marxist.
Bizarrely. Right. Yeah. Well, it's not bizarre because I write about, write about rugby league because it's part of Northern working class culture in a lot of towns in the North, particularly former mining towns, textile towns. Rugby league has always been part of working class culture because rugby, in 1895, rugby split into two games. Rugby union, basically middle class, privately educated base, and rugby league, which was working class, industrial working class, players who had to take time off work to be paid and lost money, so they wanted to be paid for playing. The rugby union said, no, this is a gentleman's game. We don't want any ideas of payment, although obviously they had under-the-counter payments. And so rugby league was formed in order to pay players for the time they had to take off work. And I kind of, the reason why I actually wrote a lot about it was because when I was, for a start, I come from Hull. So for a great number of people in Hull, rugby league is like your religion. But also, when I was trying to find a subject that I wanted to study at university, originally I was going to do what I've just written about, the origins of the Communist Party, but I was advised by my supervisor that thesis on labour history is 10 a penny.
Right, yeah.
If you want a career in academia, don't do that, find some other angle. And I thought, I'd done a very interesting course on...
Just like stand-up comedy.
Well, kind of, almost, yeah, but not as many gags. But I thought, I'll do rugby league. It's all about class. It's all about the same period, you know, 1895 to the 1920s. And so I did that. I got a PhD from that. But it meant that I could, in a sense, talk about working class people and their culture in a sort of political way with a small p, not about political organisations.
Well, that's the thing.
But where people felt so strongly about it.
You talk about the thing, but not through the thing, but through a kind of parallel thing.
And so it kind of, to be honest, it got away with me a bit. So I've also written the history of rugby union about the middle classes, which is actually very interesting. It's a bit like, I listened to you on Desert Island Discs and you chose A Sword of Honour, even War Sword of Honour is the book to take away with, and which I think is a great book because it's a great book anyway. But it teaches about the middle classes, yeah. how the middle and the upper classes behave.
Yeah.
And one of the things that fascinated me about the other side of the rugby split was the rugby union side. How do middle class people justify this? Because when rugby league was formed, rugby union banned anyone with any contact with the rugby league, whether he was a player or an official or even a referee, from having anything to do with rugby union. And some clubs even had, in classic McCarthyite style, when you applied to join a rugby union club, there'd be a clause there saying, are you now or have you ever been a member of a rugby league club? Which is, I'd say, it's yeah. a classic yeah, 1950s yeah, yeah. McCarthyism. Yeah. So I also wrote a lot about rugby union from get an insight into the mentality.
Right.
How the British middle class is.
Because one of the reasons, it's a separate point in a sense, but one of the reasons I think that, you know, people talk about the 1945 election, the Labour landslide, and, you know, they think it's, you know, the soldiers just wanted a better world. But I think one of the things was that they'd been working up close with the British fucking ruling class for 5 years, and they'd seen what arseholes they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's never mentioned again, you know, in any history, but they'd just seen, because they'd been in much closer contact than they ever would have been, what dipshits were ruling us. And so they said, well, briefly, you know, let's, you know.
And conversely, the more intelligent members of the upper classes realised what could potentially happen. And so they were prepared to go along with it, allow Labour to nationalise the mines and everything, which is partly due to an economic need, because the people who own them couldn't run them properly.
Yeah.
But there's a kind of understanding that we've got to make concessions, otherwise we could get into a situation like, potentially revolutionary situation like in France, when the French Communist Party is the biggest party in France. Yes. Italy, the Italian Communist Party could have seized power but didn't. Civil war in Greece.
Yeah. But that's because, I mean, I think the British media and because they, recoil from ideas of class, that kind of idea of the intermingling briefly of classes is never mentioned, really.
Yeah, that's right. And it's same after World War One as well.
Right.
There's that sense that, never again, we don't have anything to do with this again. I think there's a part of that where people see what, public school officers were telling working class blokes to go over the top and kicking over footballs and rugby balls for them to chase.
Yeah.
The murderous idiocy behind that, taught people a lot of lessons that we don't want to go back to that. The wrong people are in charge.
Yeah, yeah. So the other thing is, your other strand, as it were, is the history of the British Communist Party. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the formation, because one of the things that's really interesting about British history is that, well, as you just said, there's a lot of the stuff that you're taught in school, or, you know, when you turn on BBC Four and you see Dan Snow or Lucy Wares and all these people. These great myths of how the British people have always been united.
Dominic Sandbrook. Exactly. I used to have a bit about fucking Dominic. Everything he says is wrong.
Yeah.
Twat.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the whole thing about basically nothing has ever changed. Nothing will ever change. And the natural state of Britain is that there's a hierarchy. And as long as the working classes hold off their caps to their betters, everything will be fine. And that's not the real story. And I think when you go back, so particularly what I've done in this book, I looked at the period of when Marxism in Britain becomes a real force. So from the 1880s until the formation of the Communist Party in 1920. And the story of that development towards the Communist Party is really a story of Britain almost tearing itself apart. And so in a sense, the kind of modern world starts in 1888 when you get the match women's strike over in the East End. Then you get the London Dockers have this massive strike and they win. And there's this massive outpouring of working class self-confidence. Unions get bigger and bigger, particularly for unskilled workers. You get class conflict on a scale that hasn't been seen since the Chartists. So 1893 is a massive miners' strike. Two miners are shot dead in Featherstone. you know, small mining village in Yorkshire, which also happens to be a big rugby league town. And there's a, on the put one of the pubs there, they've got a plaque that's marked both at the same time the 1893 shootings and also the foundation of Featherstone Rovers Rugby League Club. So you can see how the two things are interlocked. And then all the way up to the First World War, you get this rising sense of division. From 1910, there's, you know, millions of workers go on strike. Liverpool in 1911, there's a general strike. Two people shot dead in Liverpool. There are miners shot dead in Wales. There's a massive Dublin lockout. You get the rise of the suffragettes. And it gets to such a level that in the summer of 1914, Lloyd George, who's the Chancellor of the Exchequer then, says, look, we're in a very serious situation here. If we're not careful, we could see social disorder and the possibility of revolution across Britain. And fortunately for the ruling class, August 1914, like 5 or 6 weeks after Lloyd George makes that speech, the First World War breaks out. And it puts a
coincidence
lid on
or not?
But it probably was coincidence, but it was very, very opportune.
Yeah.
And came at just the right time. It puts the lid on it for a bit, but then as the First World War goes on, the domestic front, the so-called domestic front, you get the rise of a lot of militancy. Welsh miners go on strike in 1915. You get rent strike organised by women in Glasgow, people like Mary Barber, Ellen Crawford, organise, you know, tens of thousands of houses in Glasgow to stop paying rent. That causes people to be arrested, confrontation with the government. Then that leads to, you know, big strikes in the engineering works. Dozens of strikers are arrested, jailed, even deported from Glasgow. There's a whole bunch of people, including future Labour MP David Kirkwood, who were born and bred in Glasgow, who were exiled from Glasgow. They're not allowed to go back there, so they have to go to England. And so there's this rising tide of conflict, industrial conflict, that cuts right against the idea of, you know, sort of national unity during the war. And then by the time you get to 1917, the impact of the Russian Revolution, it gives working people in Britain an example of what's possible. So for May Day 1917, just after the February Revolution in Russia, there are 70,000 people marched through Glasgow behind red flags to mark the Russian Revolution. There's such a wave of strikes in the engineering industry that Lloyd George holds a government inquiry into what's going on. And the commission reports back very quickly and says, well, there's huge dissatisfaction against the way that people are being treated in Britain, and there's also growing dissatisfaction with the war. And then fortunately, for the government in 1918, basically the German front collapses and the war ends. And then the whole thing in 1919 takes off again, to the extent that you get a situation, March 1919, the miners vote overwhelmingly to go on strike for a pay claim. Lloyd George calls the miners, leads of the miners' union, into Downing Street and says, look, you realise that if you go on strike, it's not about the miners versus the mine owners. You're taking on the government, and no government can afford to lose a challenge like that. And we're prepared to do anything that it takes to win that. Essentially saying, yeah, if you don't back down, there'll be a civil war. And they back down. But the fear that there was of the potential for a revolution, that's not to say people were, you know, about to take power, but the fear that this would grow and grow as it had done in Germany, and particularly obviously in Russia, was really, really strong. And so you get to 1919 starts the, if you like, a kind of, the left starts to regroup, and all the different left groups, like the British Socialist Party, the more left-wing Socialist Labour Party, and the Sylvia Pankhurst Workers' Socialist Federation, they start to come together and think what we need in Britain is a party like the Bolshevik Party. And so they start to negotiate to form a Communist Party. It's not quite that simple due to a whole variety of reasons, ego, different politics, and all the usual, all the usual stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Like
anybody who's been involved in left-wing politics will understand. And it don't quite work out as they planned. And it kind of meant that the the British Communist Party was not as strong as what it probably could have been, and certainly compared to most communist parties in Europe.
And there's a lesson there for today, I think. Get people, get your shit together.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, at that time, I mean, one of the interesting things, and again, you can, this idea that Lenin was a dictator and people just jumped to attention to whatever he said. There was a massive debate going on in Britain about a lot of the things we just talked about, like what's the role of Parliament? You know, should revolutionaries stand for Parliament? And Lenin said, yeah, but it's not that Parliament's going to change anything. It's just that it's a great platform. If you get somebody elected, you can make propaganda and, you know, get yourself, basically, get yourself in the media. And then the other thing was, what about the Labour Party? Do we, you know, do we try and put the Labour Party to the test? Because the other thing that's happening is that the Labour Party has completely changed in 1918 as a kind of, before the First World War, the Labour Party was basically just a collection of trade unions and MPs. It wasn't really the Labour Party that we know today. It didn't have branches, for example. It wasn't a membership party. In 1918, it changed, became a membership party, introduced Clause 4, and also brought in a lot of former members of the Liberal Party. And so, in a sense, the what you have today, which is sort of right-wing, there's a right-wing that, you know, by and large, could easily be in the Liberal Party or the right-wing, the Tory Party, and a left-wing that's always based itself on the trade unions. That configuration came together in 1918, partly because Arthur Henderson, who was the leader of the Labour Party at the time, had gone to Russia in 1917 to see what was going on just before the Bolsheviks took power and was scared to death. And he came back and said, we can't let this happen here. We've got to get control of the workers. Otherwise, we're going to have a revolution. We're going to have civil disorder. We need a Labour Party that's actually going to bring peaceful change and stop all these horrible things that are going on in Russia. And that's why they brought Clause 4 in, to try and give the Labour Party that sense of, you know, we're a socialist party as well, but we think that you can get socialism through Parliament. You don't need any of this revolutionary talk or this talk about working people taking power. We can do it for you. And so there was a whole debate about what your attitude should be to the Labour Party and Lenin at the time. So, well, look, if they're saying we're in favour of socialism, well, let's put them to the test, see what happens, and vote for them. And then when they get in power, they'll demonstrate that they're not really socialist at all. So there's a debate about that, and people didn't necessarily agree with Lenin. There was falling out. Sylvia Pankhurst refused to join the Communist Party. John McLean, the great Glaswegian leader of the working class, the revolutionary, the person who more than anybody else in the First World War stood out against the war and said, no, this is a war that we must oppose. It's against the interests of the working class. Our real enemy is not the Germans. Our real enemy is the British ruling class. John McLean, for reasons of partially ego, partially because he didn't understand the way the world was changing, refused to take part. And so the British Communist Party didn't have some of the key leaders that had been most prominent during the First World War and in the 1919 period of civil strife involved in it. So it was always a pretty, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who disagree with this, but it was always quite a weak organisation.
Right.
In my assessment,
yeah,
compared to what you had, on the continent, for example.
I mean, and do you think that is the reason why they failed to make them, the Communist Party in Britain failed to make as much of a dent as the Communist Party did in France or Italy? Or
I think that had a lot to do with it. And I think the other problem, which goes back to what we were talking about before, is that I don't think the Communist Party ever really figured out what its attitude to the Labour Party should be.
Right.
And it always saw itself as a kind of left-wing of the Labour Party. And what it wanted to do, what it was trying to do, was to make the left leaders of the Labour Party, give them a bit more backbone. It was the more consistent left-wingers, and the leaders of the Labour left kind of, you know, needed a bit more stiffening, a bit more gingering up, as they would have said.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the problems. Again, and I think Jeremy proves that despite their best intentions, they ultimately, the left wing of the Labour Party will always ally or try to ally with the right wing of the Labour Party. And so you get that. The big test was like in the general strike. The general strike was called in 1926. And after 9 days, the right wing of the Labour Party decided to call it off, and the left wing of the Labour Party just went along with it. Yeah. Instead of saying, no, this is a betrayal, we stay out until the miners, you know, the miners get what they deserve, because the miners have been locked out, which is why there was a general strike in support,
yeah,
in support of them for better wages. Instead of saying, no, we should continue the general strike, show just how strong we are, and that will really frighten the government, and that might be able to take us forward towards building a proper opposition to the government, a revolutionary opposition to the government. The Labour left just basically went along with it and said, well, it's probably the best in the circumstances, and we can't, you know, we don't want to get into unnecessary confrontations. Government were quite prepared to get into a confrontation.
Yeah. We see that same shit repeated over and over again, don't we? I mean, those who forget the lessons of history.
Yeah.
Condemned to repeat them, George Santayana.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
When are the left going to learn, really, I suppose, is the... I suppose when they listen to this podcast,
I think this will be
the turning point. People will say the future leader of the revolution, Zapatista Q Abdullah, will say, I listened to Alexis Sales podcast in 2021 with Professor Tony Collins, and that I went madre de Dios. There's a solution right there.
If only it was so simple.
It might be.
Well, things. I mean, yeah. It's. I think basically, as in lots of things in life, it's basically sticking to your principles and saying, "Look, what do we want?" I mean, this is the thing about Marx and Engels. What they saw as communism, essentially, it's about the working class has to liberate itself by taking power and organizing society on the basis of need and the best interests of working people, of the majority, the vast, vast majority of the population. And, you know, there are all sorts of people who are going to try and divert from that course from the extreme right to lots of people in the Labour Party who are quite satisfied with the way things are.
Yeah.
And it's just basically, it's an old cliche, but, you know, being as loyal to the interests of the working class as other politicians are to the interests of the ruling class, the interests of the British ruling class.
Yeah. The fucking Guardian.
Yeah. And, well, that's the whole point about sort of the right wing of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
The so-called liberal intelligentsia, the media, media set.
Fucking bastards.
That was Professor Tony Collins. And Talal, just before we go, I believe you were on Latitude Festival last weekend.
I just got back from Latitude. Yes, it was amazing to be back amongst the throngs of people, but it's a bit of a shock to the system. I haven't been in those kind of crowds, obviously, for such a long time.
It makes you feel weird, doesn't it? I found that wedding where there was like 100 people really quite stressful.
Yeah, I've been a bit run down since returning the last couple of days, and I'm only just starting to feel better now. But fuck me, so really cool and fun. I got to see some great music. And Adam Buxton was there doing his thing, and he's great. He gave us a shout out, so shout out to him. It was nice to see him doing his thing, and Chemical Brothers and Green Tea Peng and stuff. But also, I got to perform there too.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah, of course. And it was just such a thrill. It was my second gig back. Obviously, you gave me some advice for my first gig back, Alexi, and it really worked. I seem to have not lost any of my pizzazz. I've still got it, as they say. And I was really thrilled, man. And I was actually, we were supposed to play the main comedy stage. So I went there with a group called Arabs Are Not Funny. It's a London-based collective of British Arab comedians who do a lot of gigs in London. And they got booked for Latitude Festival, which is officially a test event, so I don't know why they didn't call it a testival, but it was so nice to be back, and I loved it. And if you were there, thanks for coming.
I don't know how interesting a story it is. When I played Latitude,
you played it,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When was this?
It was a book reading that was about maybe 8 or 9 years ago. But there's actually, for those favoured few, there's actually a B&B on the site. There's like a little bed and breakfast kind of hotel, really, for a few people. And the next morning we were having breakfast, and there was this really beautiful looking black guy with his son. And he said, you guys driving back to London? We said, yeah. And he said, oh, can I come with you? Because he'd traveled by train to Latitude on a Sunday, and he'd had to change like 17 times to get there. You know, he'd had to kind of get train to Luton and then, one to Northampton and then change and then switch to pack animals over the mountains. And, he was so traumatized. So we gave him a lift back. But it was a guy called Saul Williams. He was he lived in Paris at the time and was he reckoned he'd invented slam poetry. And he was an actor and musician. And I remember his work I haven't heard much of him recently, but for a while, Six Music were playing a lot of his stuff. And we just had the most marvelous kind of drive where me and Linda, and we just got on amazingly well. I remember we were chatting so much and I was so into it that at one point I missed the turn and then we ended up in Ipswich. And then but it was just one of those magical things that happens very rarely where you meet somebody and you just get on amazingly well. And his son was by the choreographer of, I think, Beyoncé's choreographer. It was this beautiful mixed race woman. And anyway, we just had this, amazing conversation, dropped him off in London, never seen him since.
Oh.
But it was one of those sort of magical, magical events where you meet somebody and you couldn't, we kind of vaguely said, if we're in Paris or something, we'll look you up. But, it wouldn't work as a long-term relationship, but it was just a magical journey.
Beautiful things like that happen at festivals, man.
They do, yeah.
I was camping next to Mark Kermode, which was quite funny. This massive, lavish caravan, and I was in a bell tent next to him. And we saw this amazing act called Lava LaRue. She's from Ladbroke Grove, young queer singer who like really great kind of R&B vibes. And my girlfriend's a massive fan of hers. We were in the audience watching it. And then like a couple days later, we bumped into her. She was just mingling around. And my girlfriend has this really iconic haircut. She's got a really unique haircut. Mm-hmm. And she came up to my girlfriend and goes, "Do I know you? Do I recognize you? Oh my God, I feel like I know you." And it was like, my girlfriend was like fangirling over. It turns out she just noticed her from the crowd, but it's the haircut.
Yeah, yeah. That well, that's what happens at festivals, isn't it? You get to, that's why I hate them, because you get to mingle with them. people get to mingle.
Yeah.
It's awful. Oh. Monkeys driving tanks. That's what we want. More of that. If anybody at Bovington is listening to this, and we could do a tank special, KV1, T34, T34-85.
We sit in a tank and record an episode of the podcast.
Yeah, let's do that. Sit inside a fucking...
with a monkey.
Yeah, a Panzer III or a French Saumur S-35. Yeah, let's do it, man.
That would be fucking great. Someone actually on the YouTube comments suggested that you do commentary tracks for the parades. What do you call them?
The military parades. We don't really have them in Britain. But yes, I could say that doesn't work. That's a piece of shit. Yeah.
Well, we could put something together like that and make it a Patreon exclusive video. I think we could do that really easily.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and I would love to do that.
I know we promised the patrons nothing, but if I get some footage together for you and get you to do some commentary over it, I think that could be really fun.
Yeah.
Okay, let's should we get the fuck out of here? We've been here long enough. That was a long interview. Which was great. Thank you, Professor Tony Collins, for that.
Thank you. Yes. And we thought we might get him back and talk about sport, Marxism and sport.
Ooh. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's, sport is, it's as the Roman poet Juvenal said in his, Satire 10, it's bread and circuses, isn't it? And that's very much the, That's how they distract us, and that's the that is very much the world we're in right now. All right, bye bye, everybody. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.